Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Pope Benedict XVI travels to Viterbo, the city of the popes, before paying tribute to Saint Bonaventure in the tiny town of Bagnoregio. And Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, takes us through the 23rd liturgical Sunday of the year. Benedict XVI on Sunday journeyed to the city of Viterbo, some 85 kilometres north of Rome. The Pope spent an intense day in what is known as the City of the Popes, meeting with authorities, celebrating Mass, and praying in two local sanctuaries before travelling to the tiny town of Bagnoregio nearby to pay homage to the relics of Saint Bonaventure in the cathedral there. Viterbo is an interesting city with many historical, architectural and artistic treasures. By far the most interesting and magnificent building in the medieval centre is the Papal Palace. The building itself was completed in 1266, ready to receive the Papal Court when it decided to flee the turbulence of Rome.
The Pope stayed for some 10 years. There were actually few French popes who were elected throughout this period.
Michele Ciniti is a tour guide who specialises in Viterbo and the surrounding Tuscia area.
Clement IV, Urban IV, actually, he was the very first one who was elected. He's the one who instituted the Corpus Domini festivity as well. And the last pope who was in Viterbo before the court was sent back to Rome was Martin IV.
Michele explained to me that no less than five conclaves were held in the rooms of this fortress residence, including a conclave that lasted 33 months before it elected the new pope, Gregory X, in 1271.
It was something devised up, trumped up to speed up the election of a pope, which dragged on for nearly 33 months. There were only actually 18 cardinals who ultimately were forced into the papal palace by key. That's why the word conclave, which is derivative from Latin cum clave.
The stratagem bore fruit and the cardinals got down to work.
Eventually, as they have come up with a negotiation, a deacon who was not out of those 18 and who stayed far away in the Holy Land and who had the name of Tebaldo de Visconti was elected as pope. He became priest and he's the one who afterwards in the Council of Lyon enforced the rule which is still now pursued in the Sistine Chapel whenever a pope is to be elected.
Is it true? Do they still elect a pope behind lock and key?
That's what they say. This regulation has still been kept alive ever since 1271, which is when this Gregory X came out.
Meanwhile, Michele revealed to me Viterbo became extremely popular with the press in the run-up to Pope Benedict XVI's election in April 2005.
Before this pope was elected, lots of foreign broadcasting networks from all over the world came to report where the very first conclave was held, which is just inside the Papal Palace, which everyone can see in the city of Viterbo.
Yes, it's actually called the Room of the Conclave, isn't it?
Yes, the Room of Conclave actually is now a bit empty one because lots of trappings have been removed and taken away. But the location of the conclave can be still visited.
During his intense Viterbo morning, Pope Benedict also took time to visit the sanctuary of Santa Rosa, St. Rose, stopping briefly to admire the amazing Macchina di Santa Rosa, which Michele told me is no machine at all. It's a 5-ton, 30-metre-tall lighted tower topped by a statue of Santa Rosa, the patron saint of Viterbo, credited with saving the city from a plague in the 17th century.
I would like to clarify, first of all, why machine, which is machina, which is derivative from Latin machina, which I think is very close to the English scaffolding. It's just a huge structure now, which has been hefted by over 100 devotees of St. Rosa. And they have to go through a sort of test, which is just to gauge their own capability, which is just hefting a huge box, which is about 160 kilos heavy. And they have to heft it with self-confidence for about 90 yards inside the church where the guild, the union of the Facchini has been represented. And this takes place every year because the local community wants to remember another help given over the city by this patron saint, Rose, who had lived 4 centuries earlier, back to the 1200s.
And then, Michele told me, the 100 chosen porters proceed to carry the machine and Saint Rose through the streets of Viterbo every year on the 3rd of September. The machine itself is an amazing object, which contemporary artists, architects and engineers compete to design periodically.
And every 5 years, as you know, the draft, the plan of this architecture, which is very beautiful, changes. So this year, there will be the very first of those 5 years to follow, and I can tell you that the architect who designed the machine is brother of the astrophysicist Vittori, and he's an astronaut, and he's a teacher of architecture, if I'm not mistaken, at Chicago's University. So it's something which everybody has to see, and where there are no boundaries, everybody joins together to enjoy this and to live this back to the 1600s when, for the first time, this was celebrated.
Later in the day, the Pope took time to visit and to pray at the sanctuary of the Madonna della Quercia, the Madonna of the Oak Tree, who is also, Michele told me, credited for having saved the city from plague.
The plague regressed thanks to the worship of the local community to a picture. This picture was Madonna and the child who had been formerly painted on a tile, and this was set into an oak tree in the middle of nowhere. So people believed that this was very, very good help for the community for the plague to regress, and that's why everybody wanted to fulfill a vow, a sort of architectural vow. And that's why the local community and the Church of Rome, they joined the forces just to make this come true. And this took about 100 years for the architecture to be carried out.
Michele was adamant that this is really a very special place.
Everybody now compares this sanctuary to a present-day Lourdes, a sanctuary of the 1500s. And he's not the only one. He's just the ultimate pope of a long host of popes. There were about over a dozen who have come up to now, including John Paul II, to see the sanctuary. When John Paul II came, he wanted to leave his own testimony to worship, adding a crown of gold just on the head of Mary and Child.
In the afternoon, Pope Benedict travelled to the tiny town of Bagnoregio, which is quite close to Viterbo. His mission here was very dear to his heart, as Bagnoregio is the hometown of Saint Bonaventure, one of the two major intellectual influences on Pope Benedict's entire theological formation, together with St. Augustine. What's more, in Germany, scholars must write 2 dissertations. The first is to receive a doctoral degree, the second is to qualify for a professional post, and the young Joseph Ratzinger, in the mid-1950s, wrote this second postdoctoral thesis on St. Bonaventure and his understanding of history.
St. Bonaventure is just a sort of a nickname, because his actual name was Giovanni Fidanza. He was sick, so he was offered by his mother to St. Francis. So when St. Francis healed him, he wanted to change his name. It wouldn't be ever since Giovanni Fidanza, but Bonaventura, which is good luck. So he then followed the Franciscan order. He became a minister of the order. He taught theology in France at the very, very important French University of Sorbonne in Paris. He was buried in France, but before being buried, he's the one who did a great help to the Church of Rome to prepare the Council of Lyon, where the aforementioned rule of the conclave had been instituted. And when he was buried, unfortunately, his body was violated by the heretics. So what you can see now inside the San Nicola's Cathedral is only one of his arms and the Bible where he studied on.
And now we celebrate the 23rd liturgical Sunday of the year with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus left Tyrian territory and returned by way of Sidon to the Sea of Galilee, into the district of the Ten Cities. Some people brought him a deaf man who had a speech impediment and begged him to lay his hand on him. Jesus took him off by himself, away from the crowd. He put his fingers into the man's ears, and, spitting, touched his tongue. Then he looked up to heaven and emitted a groan. He said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. At once the man's ears were opened. He was freed from the impediment and began to speak plainly. Then he enjoined them strictly not to tell anyone. But the more he ordered them not to, the more they proclaimed it. Their amazement went beyond all bounds. He has done everything well. He makes the deaf hear and the mute speak.
Unless we're really familiar with the geography of the Holy Land, the peregrinations of our Lord described in the opening words of this Gospel can only confuse us. Tyre and Sidon are on the Mediterranean coast road that runs north to Beirut. Jerusalem is a good 130 miles away to the southeast. What was Jesus doing in Tyrian territory before he left it to take a very roundabout way back to the Sea of Galilee and the district of the Ten Cities? It seems likely that he left Palestine to get away from the eternal arguments with the Pharisees and have some time alone with his disciples. For we read,
He left that place and set out for the territory of Tyre. There he went into a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. But he could not pass unrecognized.
And in fact, he's immediately pursued by the Syrophoenician woman, whose daughter had an unclean spirit. The disciples beg Jesus to send her away. But he takes the opportunity to test her faith and show the disciples how even a pagan, a Gentile, can be an example. The miracle takes place offstage. When the woman goes home, she finds her daughter cured. And without more ado, Jesus is off again. But not, as we might think, turning round to go back south. No, he continues north to Sidon. In a brief note, we read that today Sidon is the terminal of the oil pipeline from Saudi Arabia and has a refinery. But in ancient times, under Persians, Greeks and Romans, it was an important Phoenician seaport, exporting chiefly glass. Its gardens, moreover, were celebrated. Tyre, on the other hand, was founded as a satellite to Sidon, but, we're told, it soon overshadowed the mother city. For its merchants founded colonies and ports along the North African coast, including Carthage. And Tyre was famous for something else. When H.V. Morton was walking along the beach nearby, he saw what he called the thin coloured seashell from which, in ancient times, the famous Tyrian purple was made. The shell was that of a mollusk of the genus purpura, related to snails and whelks, and produced a purple dye. It was very costly to make and soon became the mark of royalty. And although the colour for a cardinal is red, when a man is created cardinal, we say he is raised to the purple. Tyre has yet one more claim to fame. When Solomon was building his temple, he called on King Hiram of Tyre to help him, and Hiram's workmen brought fir and cedar down from Lebanon, towing it on rafts down the coast. And so the inside of the temple was lined with cedar wood, and the Holy of Holies was built of cedar wood from the floor to the rafters. So much for Tyre and Sidon. And since Mark gives us no details of what happened during the journey from Sidon back to the vicinity of the lake, we can only assume that those days belong to Jesus and his friends alone. In the countryside they passed through, Jesus was not known, so the little group would have had the privacy they needed. Until they reached the district of the Ten Cities, the Decapolis, as it was known, it was a region of Greek cities, a commercial league whose member cities enjoyed a certain autonomy, while loosely under the control of the Roman governor of Syria. H.V. Morton fills in the picture for us.
This Decapolis was a league of at first 10 Greek cities. Some of them were perched high on the brown mountains that frown down on the Sea of Galilee from the east. Others were placed to the south of the lake near the Jordan, and some stood high on the eastern uplands. All 10 arranged, however, with a strategical eye to the ancient trade routes commanding the way to the Mediterranean Sea, across the plain of Esdraelon, and the caravan roads from Damascus to Petra. In the time of Christ, they were brilliant, rich cities, in constant touch with Greece and in daily contact with the varied foreign traffic that passed through them, coming north from Egypt through the Gorge of Petra and flowing south from Damascus over the long, brown desert road. The Decapolis was also a little archipelago of Greek culture set in a wide ocean of hills and desert.
Where exactly Jesus performed the miracle recounted in today's Gospel, we're not told. Mark is the only evangelist to tell of this particular miracle. But Matthew writes that after Jesus had cured the daughter of the Canaanite woman, he went on from there and reached the shores of the Sea of Galilee, and he went up into the hills.
He sat there, and large crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the crippled, the blind, the dumb, and many others. These they put down at his feet, and he cured them. The crowds were astonished to see the dumb speaking, the cripples whole again, and the lame walking, and the blind with their sight, and they praised the God of Israel.
In Mark's Gospel today, we're told only that some people brought him a deaf man who had a speech impediment and begged him to lay his hand on him. The old Vulgate version had one deaf and dumb. But it's not so much the exact condition of the man which is striking in this miracle, but the way in which it's performed. First of all, the way our Lord takes the man off by himself, and then the gestures he used. As Sheed writes, he healed the man not by a word or a touch only.
He put his fingers into the man's ears, put some of his own spittle onto the man's tongue. Jewish and pagan healers sometimes used their spittle, and Jesus would do it once again. It is a symbolic way of associating the whole self with the healing action.
Next, Jesus looked up to heaven and emitted a groan, as he did later when he raised Lazarus from the dead. Comments Sheed.
We are reminded that a miracle was not for him simply a wave of the hand or a wave of the will. Power went out of him.
Then came the Aramaic word ephphatha, meaning be opened, and the miracle was performed. In the old rite of baptism, this healing was brought to mind when the priest wet his fingers with saliva and touched the ears and mouth of the person being baptized, speaking the word ephphatha. When we hear of people who've always been deaf, the natural reaction is almost always one of pity. But for some reason, when older people become hard of hearing, as the phrase goes, they're often the butt of jokes. They hear one word for another, and those with perfect hearing smile meaningly at each other and laugh about it when the deaf person is not around. Before the discreet hearing aids of our day were invented, the deaf person was often provided with an ear trumpet, and this in itself was cause for amusement. Let's listen to a light-hearted extract from a short story by Gerald Bullitt, entitled Wax. The old man in question is taken to the doctor by his daughter, who wants him sent to a lunatic asylum, because, she says, he doesn't answer when spoken to and doesn't recognise them anymore.
Heedless of everything external, and quite unaware of the fate in store for him, Grandpa Boydell sat quiet in his corner. For longer now than he could easily remember, his private being, the city of himself, had been strangely secluded from the outer world, walled round with quietness. All sounds were agreeably dimmed. He missed, and was glad to miss, the scraping of the children's chairs on the floor, the baby's howling, the strident voice of his daughter enjoining good behaviour, the street noises that had irked him for so long, the shouting and the rumble, were now ended. It was as if those hitherto snorting, roaring vehicles were being moved by magic over a road of silk. He watched them from the window and marvelled.
The deafness of Grandpa Boydell, however, is very soon remedied. Once the doctor has seen into his ears with an electric torch, he gets to work with a syringe.
Grandpa Boydell sat alone in his silence, but ruthless war was being waged on that sanctuary. The roar of water in his ears became punctuated by a tearing and a crackling, and then suddenly it was as if the whole earth went up in one hideous explosion. The world with its trampling feet, its blare of trumpets, its multitudinous drums rushed in on him. His ears were open.
Levity apart, the world of the deaf is a world of isolation, so that when this barrier is overthrown, there is real reason for rejoicing. Something of this kind happened in the late 19th century, when an American child named Helen Keller, blind and deaf from the age of 19 months, was put under the tuition of Anne Sullivan, who taught her to associate words with objects and to read and spell through touch. Later, Helen learned to use sign language and to speak, graduating in 1904 and becoming a famous lecturer and crusader for the handicapped. Helen was blind, but these words of hers on the vision she possessed give us pause for thought.
I am often conscious of beautiful flowers and birds and laughing children, whereto my seeing associates there is nothing. They sceptically declare that I see light that never was on sea or land. But I know that their mystic sense is dormant, and that is why there are so many barren places in their lives. They prefer facts to vision.
Among the many sayings regarding deafness, there is one which is quoted in a psalm, to be as deaf as an adder. Referring to unjust judges, the psalmist declares that they are deaf as the adder.
They are deaf as the adder that blocks its ears, so as not to hear the magician's music and the clever snake charmer's spells.
In the East, if a viper entered the house, the charmer was sent for to entice the snake and put it into a bag. According to tradition, the viper tried to stop its ears when the charmer uttered his incantation by putting one ear to the ground and twisting its tail into the other. In other words, there are none so deaf as those who do not want to hear. And what of the dumb? Although there's no direct connection with deafness, dumbness frequently follows as a matter of course. As the deaf person hears no sound, to make sounds doesn't come spontaneously. In that same short story, Wax, the old man asks the doctor a question, and we read, the sound of his voice astonished him. Our gospel only tells us that the man Jesus cured had a speech impediment, and today we know that with speech therapy, many impediments can be removed. But as for the totally dumb, I remember the very first play I was in at school. It was called The Dumb Wife of Cheapside, and told of a husband who went to every doctor he could find in search of a cure for his dumb wife. But when her tongue is finally loosed, he is submerged by the torrent of words, and in desperation he resorts to the only remedy and begs the doctor to make him deaf. Seriously, though, our use of words is so often a misuse. We employ more words than are needed, confusing the issue and on occasions doing real damage. And Jesus warned that for every unfounded word men utter, they will answer on Judgment Day, since it is by your words you will be acquitted and by your words condemned. A sobering thought. The Taoist philosopher Chuang Tzu put it concisely.
The purpose of a fish trap is to catch fish, and when the fish are caught, the trap is forgotten. The purpose of a rabbit snare is to catch rabbits. When the rabbits are caught, the snare is forgotten. The purpose of the word is to convey ideas. When the ideas are grasped, the words are forgotten. Where can I find a man who has forgotten words? He is the one I would like to talk to.
In a book on desert spirituality, Henri Nouwen makes this comment.
Silence guards the inner heat of religious emotions. This inner heat is the life of the Holy Spirit within us. Thus, silence is the discipline by which the inner fire of God is tended and kept alive.
And the writer then quotes Diodocus of Fotiki, one of the desert fathers, who lived in the Egyptian desert during the 4th and 5th centuries.
When the door of the steam bath is continually left open, the heat inside rapidly escapes through it. Likewise, the soul, in its desire to say many things, dissipates its remembrance of God through the door of speech, even though everything it says may be good. Thereafter, the intellect, though lacking appropriate ideas, pours out a welter of confused thoughts to anyone it meets, as it no longer has the Holy Spirit to keep its understanding free from fantasy. Ideas of value always shun verbosity, being foreign to confusion and fantasy. Timely silence, then, is precious, for it is nothing less than the mother of the wisest thoughts.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. That's all from the English feature programme and from me, Linda Bordoni, today. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.